You ever have a moment where you use a piece of software for the first time and it just feels like magic? For instance, I can remember exactly where I was sitting in a co-working space in Boulder, Colorado, the very first time I used Sketch. Within minutes, I knew that this was the tool that I've been waiting for. And I think that I just had one of those moments again. Because for years, I've been wanting someone to do to After Effects what Sketch did to Adobe Illustrator for me. And it finally happened. The product is called Jitter, and it's like Figma for motion design. It's 10 times simpler than After Effects. There's a Figma plugin, beautiful out-of-the-box animations, and that's why I'm going all in on Jitter as the way that I bring my designs to life with motion. If you want to join me, you can head to dive.club/jitter. That's J-I-T-T-E-R. Now on to the episode.
I think one of them is a sense of constantly looking for the art of the possible. So when challenged with a very difficult task, not trying to block it in to say, like, what is it that we can do given these constraints, but really to ask the question, I wonder, what if we could do this? Is that possible? Like, let's try it. And I think that that's a really intangible thing, but it is born of a place that you really are aiming for the highest possible end outcome and are willing to fight tooth and nail for that, rather than looking for the most pragmatic solution.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. Today, I'm talking with Michael Wandelmeyer, who is the head of design at one of my favorite agencies, MetaLab. Now, the goal of this conversation is to really study how MetaLab operates so that you can pull out specific tactics that you can use when working with clients of your own. We get into creative processes, presentation tactics, and how to succeed in an agency model. So let's start broad and hear from Michael about how design at MetaLab works.
To understand like why we do it a certain way is you need to know a little bit about MetaLab. We are a relatively small agency working specifically in product, so about like 200 people, but those people are fully remote and distributed everywhere. Was founded in Vancouver, Victoria, BC in Canada. And there is a chunk of our team that is, you know, in those two cities, but people are in Italy, in France, in the UK, South Africa, India, New Zealand, Australia. People are everywhere. So a remote first culture is really about like how we operate. And then our teams to be successful are very small and very senior. So like a typical nucleus project team will be one major representative of each discipline. So like design, user research, technology, and product thinking. And then depending on the type of client or the project we're on, that can morph and shift, but clients typically fall into two buckets. We work with historically a lot of early stage founders, which makes us really different from, let's say, some of the big agencies who work in product that we, you know, you would be familiar with. Slack, as the kind of like origin story for MetaLab, was like one of those first use cases where doing the design for the first instance of Slack was done directly with the founder. That first iteration came out, and we've continued to work with founders in that model for, I'd say, a good half of our projects. And then the other half would be working with, you know, the big names of the world, working on some of their major core products or their service experience or e-commerce, all of those pieces. And then you mostly see shifts in the project types and formats, but the teams themselves still say by nature, very small and senior to be able to move fast and like really quickly and like deliver projects at speed with really high quality and like quite a lot of ambition. So that informs the shape of the projects we do. We don't have these major structures you sometimes see with like, you know, oversight and then like a core team and then two or three production teams around that. It's not at all how we structure our work.
So I want to go really in the weeds on like a typical client process, really just as a way to help listeners understand what they can learn from how design works at MetaLab. So maybe we can even go to pretty close to the beginning of that process and zoom in on that first kickoff meeting or whatever you're going to call it, like that first touch point where you're really establishing direction for the project, where you're getting all the creative juices flowing. How are you structuring that meeting as a project leader? And then what are some of the things that designers are really making sure to pull out of that conversation?
Oh, that's a great question. I think like it's the most important moment in a project. And even if you're going to work with a client for like multiple years, that first instance of getting together to understand what are we going to work on together? What's the most difficult challenges to crack? What is the approach that's going to make for a successful collaboration? And actually getting started into co-ideating to solution for that is like so important. we try to plan them to be like covering a really wide range of concerns, from, you know, what's going on in the world in relation to your company and your product, to where do you situate yourself and what are the challenges you're seeing. So almost like a rebrief to understand if we've truly understood what they've come to us for. But then we want to inject a bit of our own perspective to be able to challenge or to, you know, really crack open things that may seem straightforward on the surface, and to expose where there could be hidden complexity, whether it be like, you know, technology or operational or just human and brand related stuff, like what's going to be difficult about this project. But ultimately, we really want to create a mindset right from the start of co-creation, like break down that old agency model of like, you've commissioned us to do this and we're going to keep bringing you solutions and you feedback on them. Like, instead, we want to use those initial workshops to set up activities that are going to be engaging the client as a co-participant, so that we don't even use the word client anymore. It's like literally the team and what are we doing together on this. And there's a range of activities that can usually get you in that headspace right away. Assumption mapping is one that we do. So our UX researchers lead one where people just throw out all the things that we think we know that are important to the project, and then sort them by like how relevant they are and meaningfully impactful versus how much do we think we know them. And the things that are going to be potentially crazy important and also very unknown are the things that we're going to first dig into and drill into from a research and like market scans and like just coming up with ideas perspective. So right off the bat, we almost break down all of the formality that you usually get around something and try to take it right down to a clean slate.
Is there more on this topic? Like, let's say that I'm a designer at MetaLab. I'm actually walking into my first instance of being a project lead. Are there certain exercises or tactics or other frameworks in addition to assumption mapping that you're equipping me with to make sure that I crush that meeting?
Yeah. So I think like especially design leads will be interested with some of the journey and opportunity mapping. So very typical exercise would be to try to not think of it by just what is the feature set or what is the, you know, value we're going to deliver, but try to understand the human context. And it's not to create these really expansive journey maps, but typically we'll make something with like maybe four big buckets, major stages of the experience someone goes through using a product. Like, let's say you're TripAdvisor, who we worked with, and it's about planning a trip and like, what do I want to know? What are my considerations? What am I doing? But against that, we'll start to create like a really good understanding of like, oh, let's use the client to help us understand pain points. So that'll be the things that we first map along a journey. And they'll have it from customer feedback, from testimonials, from like, you know, call center calls where people complain or help center stuff, and just their own experience in the business. And then against those, we'll start to be like, well, what are the meaningful things that we might do as opportunities in terms of design solutions against them? And then typically each journey is drawn like a circle. So imagine almost like an Audi logo where there's like four circles side by side. Well, that's to recognize that people don't just water slide through a journey naturally. They actually sit in shopping around or considering for quite a bit. So we put like a moment where those circles touch to be like, well, what would be a meaningful feature or experience that we can deliver that'll help them shift from being in shopping around to now finding the thing that I want or considering? And those typically like help us be anchored in a human perspective, where it's really easy to just start talking about like, oh, this part of the experience, this homepage, or, you know, that feature or this onboarding.
I love that Audi example. That's an interesting mental model that I haven't heard before. It makes a lot of sense. So let's continue our hypothetical project timeline here. So you've come out of that meeting, you have this dump of information. Some of it maybe might even feel a little bit conflicting on the surface. What are you then doing to make sense of everything, establish momentum, and map out some of those next steps internally?
Yeah, the momentum piece and what you mentioned is actually so important. So there have been, in, you know, our least successful occasions, a desire to do a really long scientific synthesis of everything that we've learned, try to plot it all out, and then create the Swiss watch of a perfect plan for a product or an application. And what was missing from those was like a strong, informed point of view, even a personal point of view from our teams that challenge the client on, you know, like the just obvious direction of where this might go. So to kind of head that off, something that I started like about 3 or 4 years ago, and it's really caught on, was doing a thing called a ridiculously early hypothesis. And what this meant was to try to come back after a week of kickoff with a really strong, structured, narrative-driven point of view as to what we should be doing next, and to present that to get a reaction to the client so that we don't give like some four-week span of like product definition without having really put an idea forward. And I found that it's like so much more productive to be working on a hypothesis as in we think the product should be this and to continue to co-evolve it together than to try to go away and leave someone wondering what it's going to be and then come back with a big ta-da and then have them either approve it and we're like, yay, or challenge it and we're like, we're out of time. We can't do that work together. So the ridiculously early hypothesis is called that because it's intentionally like a little bit impulsive. It's like, we've spent a week together really cracking into your problem. Here's what we think. And you present it in like a narrative structure so that there really is almost like we're talking about your original business problem, your original context, the challenges we see, what that means we might want to do for you, and what we think is so important that we got to put it at the front, and how that results in a shaping of an experience that has these features or this character and not some of the other things we might have considered.
I know a lot of what you're doing is very client specific and you can't share it, but can you help shape what that might look like for someone who's listening and they're like, okay, I get that at a high level, but like, how does that translate into what I'm actually saying and showing to a potential client?
Yeah, I can give the example from like the first time we use it was on Upwork, which is basically a marketplace for finding people who can help you with any form of like creative or knowledge work. So if you want a video editor or a designer or even an accountant, Upwork is a place where you can do that. And this was right when the pandemic had started. They had been a traditional kind of like temp hiring service. They had been a merger of two other companies. And the CEO, Hayden Brown, had really put forward this proposition that we want to be something else, the future of where people do independent work. And that had been established at a big, high level. They had done a rebrand with Porto Rocha, an amazing brand shop, huge fan of. And then they came to us to be like, okay, how do we translate that into an actual product experience and feature set that's quite different from what we do today? And we spent a week workshopping as described, and very clearly some themes emerged that had nothing to do with the original things that we had talked about. Like people had talked about making better collaboration, getting to a point where you can get the job done together more effectively, but other things came up that were equally important. So geographic equanimity and equity, as in a lot of people went to that platform and saw that a freelancer was from India as a developer, or Ukraine as a designer, and then all these things crept in, like they would offer them a lower rate for that project, or they would seek them out because they would expect it to be lower cost, or they would expect it to be potentially like better value for them. And what we wanted to do was create a platform that actually breaks down those barriers and creates a better conditions for people everywhere to work. And that translates into things like, well, do we show a location or not of a person on a portfolio of their work? Do we show more of the work or help humanize someone by showing more of themselves as a human? And if we do, what do we encourage people to show and not, and to create a better exchange there? And that became a major pillar of the product that was only exposed by our designers going, hey, we think this is important. This will be extremely differentiating for you. It'll make such a better set of conditions for your talent. I don't like the word talent in that context, but the people who supply the services as opposed to the buyers of it. And this was like a strong point of view that came through in the conversation. And you know what? The clients had been thinking that too, but it hadn't been expressed or put on paper and made a priority. So, you know, we were really proud to inject an angle into the work that had not been present in the original brief.
I like the really early hypothesis because, you know, I've been on both sides of the table now in this agency model, and some have really positive experiences and some that didn't go as well. And I think one of the worst case scenarios is you have that next touch point and there's something being displayed or shown and you realize that actually we were not on the same page at that previous touch point. And, you know, maybe we've spent a week or more kind of going down the wrong path a little bit. Are there other things that you're doing to protect against that outcome, or other strategies that you're using to really drive alignment with a client and make sure that you're on the same page?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even before getting into that, getting to that point in 1 week is actually a success. It's not a failure. We've had that happen so many times. A failure is when you go like 6 weeks into a project and only then realize that you have a major disconnect or some major consideration that wasn't surfaced, or even just a personal desire of the client that wasn't out there. So we do a range of things. We do stakeholder interviews one-on-one that are really carefully constructed to reveal like who might be meaningful stakeholders and participants in the project who are not actually involved in the project. And that's a great way to find out what will make, especially in a large organization, a successful outcome. You sometimes can work with a team and get perfect alignment, and then T-minus 1 week, some member of, like, I don't know, the VP of operations or marketing joins and they go, you haven't spoken to me. We haven't talked about this aspect of the work. And it can derail things. So we really want to be inclusive and broad in our thinking to make sure we get a really good capture in those moments. The workshop activities are usually a good way to cover a broad range of concerns really early on. So we use things like definitions of success, where we might talk about success for the business with an activity called blue sky, dark sky. What would be like great outcomes versus negative outcomes? And they typically expose some of the concerns or fears that the client have. We do a lot of ideation and mapping exercises, and that typically helps capture a rough sense of scope, as in, are we building one app, a dozen apps? Are we building a desktop or mobile experience? Are we focusing on these feature sets? Will there be a community or not? Like, there's so many things that we can begin the discussion on and have a tangible point of reference for that, you know, evolves together. We're co-creating it, but at least it's not just in people's minds or it was mentioned in passing in a Zoom call and then forgotten. It's having a point of reference, a shared source of truth, usually a fig jam board or a Miro board.
Have you had situations where key stakeholders simply don't agree?
Often. And I mean, not in an unproductive way. Like, the funny thing is that often the best solutions come from those disagreements, because a lot of large companies, it's less frequent in our startup work, because what you're working with directly is like a single or dual founder situation. And they have a strong vision. They've just been off of shopping it around for, you know, for venture funding, that kind of thing. They've really clarified their proposition and they have clarity for themselves. But large enterprise work often is the first time that people who may not even work together in an organization get together in a joint venture to do something of a higher order that's significant to their customers, something that'll give a better end-to-end experience from the brand. But they've become siloed, you know, someone who's owns the checkout flow, you know, or someone who owns the onboarding might not be the same person who's responsible for marketing, or, you know, all of those things don't often connect. So we've had many kickoffs where the spiciest conversations in the room are between members of the client team, as opposed to us being particularly challenging. And a big part of our function is to drive alignment, to find methods and ways to understand what are the intrinsic motivators. You know, big companies have everything from really practical stuff like targets that they are all responsible for to just general areas of interest. How do we get people on the same page?
What are some of the ways that you have to evolve your own process based off of whether you're working with one of those more founder-driven early stage companies versus this really big, well-known enterprise?
I would say that like the largest amount of work that MetaLab does outside of actually doing the work is continually debating whether the way we do things is the right way to do it. We have some tangible mechanisms. So our product manager team is constantly performing retros, ways for us to have not only with the client, but internal to our teams, learnings as to like how successful were we, like what worked, what didn't work, what was even just led to good quality of life while working versus, you know, like just things that felt stressful or difficult. And all of that is constantly being collated and discussed in things like team meetings to try to create new things. I think the organic stuff is what I like more, though, is whenever someone finds a tool or a way of doing something that works, it almost just catches on. And that's a form of evolution that happens on its own. Early concepting called like Tarantino's was like a really big one that caught on like wildfire. Constantine, one of our design directors, came up with the idea of doing like Pulp Fiction. You start at the end and then you back out of the solution, and to give designers ultimate freedom in a first couple of days to be unconstrained by requirements or even like a hard specific goal, and just envision in high fidelity the most natural way to express yourself concepts for what the product might be. And the funny thing is that that changes dramatically the conversation around what we think is possible. Often, you know, the perceived barriers to doing something really cool are mostly in your mind, and you self-censor and do more conservative or pragmatic solutions. Whereas like a little bit of freedom is so much more enjoyable, and it's a little blip at the beginning of the project that's not a high risk thing, like you're betting all on it. And people forget to do that stuff. So naming something like a ridiculously early hypothesis or a Tarantino has a way of just promoting recall. People go, oh, we should do a Tarantino. And then it happens.
You're making me curious, like, how much the MetaLab process varies depending on the team that has been constructed and just the personalities of the people who are stewarding the process. Because, yeah, I can see how there's like this really organic component of it. Are there other elements of how you work that feel a little bit more top down, where it's like, no, this is actually like what we believe about the design process and how we work as an agency?
Yeah, so there is a through line, a spine of our core process, and it has certain pillars that we feel pretty strongly about over time have led to like just better outcomes. And those things tend to stay constant, and I can get into a couple of them. But those other things I'm describing, there's a lot of room for flex, you know, as long as that main through line stays the same. I think having like a really strong human-centric, research-grounded start that's paired with a lot of design exploration. So not only being strategically thinking, but also putting pen to paper and exploring freely in design has always led to better outcomes for us. So we try to do the two concurrently in the very beginning through, I would say, like a product definition phase. And that sounds like a very definite thing, but it actually has a combination of a almost like a double diamond, only we don't really use that exact methodology, but a very classic methodical phase paired with a lot of wildcard design exploration to still disrupt what otherwise might be a little bit too empirical or logical. 1 week sprints. We work really rapidly and at high pace of iteration, usually with a couple of touch points that are quite formal throughout a 1 week sprint. And it can be extremely taxing and grueling from like an urgency perspective, but it also keeps us from getting mired in like unproductive spinning or to lose track of the arc of what we're trying to achieve, or going too long without meaningful contribution or feedback, either from user testing or from our clients. And that's one that we've almost never shifted on. I think the way we present work is like a really important part, as in like this kind of like a dual format. Some of them are much more summative and big, kind of like, I don't want to say big reveals, but big presentations of end-to-end cohesive thinking to make sure that that framing and context is really there. And then the other one is to be constantly able to effectively present day-to-day, week-to-week in the work. We use Loom a lot to be able to just share ideas, to be able to like have a human voice being left behind or passed on. Like clients can take a Loom and pass it on to someone else who wasn't in the meeting. And between Looms and meeting recordings, like we have a really good way to make sure that like you're always communicating rather than documenting. We're actually a very light on documentation culture. The most of it comes in when we're, you know, directly doing design and engineering in parallel. And I think that that's when you want to have an additional layer, like really solid documentation. But when we're doing foundational design explorations or, you know, a design only project, where we're working with the client's development team. We try to keep it really lean. Notion, Figma, Slack, Miro sometimes, very few decks. Most of them are in Pitch because it's a tool that we worked on and that, you know, we really enjoy.
I want to put a pin in the Loom comment because I want to return to it. But maybe even as a way to like reflect on everything that you've shared from a process standpoint, I want to toss a hypothetical your way, which is, let's say that for one reason or the other, you decide actually you want to venture out and work for yourself as a freelance independent design practice. What are the elements of the MetaLab process that you would definitely want to take with you to incorporate into your own freelance practice?
Oh yeah. I mean, there are so many, and you know, I've always cross compared against like a range of like former agencies and contexts that I've worked in to try to evaluate what works. And that flows both ways. You know, everybody brings their experience into it, but MetaLab does have a few things that I think are always worth keeping. I think truly designing to find an answer, not finding an answer to be able to design, is a basic principle. As in, like, you absolutely have to get into it and be evaluating a solution. And that's not to put aside strategy. It's actually one of my biggest areas of passion in the work, is to be using elements of product strategy, brand strategy, experience strategy very formally in the work, but never at the expense of actually solutioning through, you know, looking through a prototype or even just like working something out live with a client, that kind of thing. it just becomes too cyclical and abstract if you're not doing it in relation to the work itself. And our designers are like constantly designing and prototyping almost simultaneously. Figma's gotten to the point with their prototyping tools that you can almost do the same thing that you might achieve in Principle or After Effects, or, you know, quite effectively. And most of our demos are walkthroughs. They're not looking at this screen and let's evaluate the next one. So I would never let go of that.
I'd like to zoom in on the storytelling piece a little bit, which you've kind of touched on here and there. And obviously, like, there's the application where you are presenting some meaningful body of work to a client and you're thinking through the presentation. But you also talk about the importance of storytelling in the informal working context, the words that you used. Can you talk a little bit more about what that looks like and what you mean by that?
Totally. I mean, first, the reason for the storytelling being so important is, like I was mentioning, great ideas dying from lack of good execution. Well, the other number one reason why they don't work out is often because they're miscommunicated or misinterpreted, especially when you're doing something new and weird. Like the first time someone thought that, like, a, I don't know, pinch to zoom would be a good idea, they might have explained that wrong and it could have never happened. Or, I don't know, something else that we now take for granted, you know, and seeing is believing on a prototype sometimes. But often great ideas get outright rejected because people didn't set them up, didn't explain them in a way that connects it back to why are we doing this. So storytelling is like a pretty fundamental tool to being able to see work that involves a lot of people see the light of day at the end. You know, if you're working with two people, you don't need storytelling. But if you're working with five or more, it becomes like essential. And people are aware of it when you're making, like, let's say a big presentation for the end of a project, or let's say you're pitching work and you want to make a pitch. Those are moments where it seems obvious. Let's employ a good narrative structure, tell a compelling story. But the ones that really matter happen like in a midweek demo or when you're trying to set up a workshop that's going to be important to come to a conclusion. And the designers I've seen be the most successful are the ones who internalized good storytelling in the bigger formal version so well that they still deliver, you know, even the most casual feature explanation with that same point of view as to how to capture and engage the interest of your audience, have them understand the why behind what you're doing and the intent, and to like really be bought in and suddenly become a collaborator rather than a critiquer. And I think that that's like the ultimate goal. We actually, you know, put so much emphasis on it internally. We recently had a workshop with Ian Wharton. He's like a founder of Aid Health in the UK, and he does a lot of classes on this. And I literally did it a day ago with our team, and it was so inspiring to just take someone else's perspective on what good storytelling looks like in the context of product and experience design. And it's like, you could spend your whole life learning storytelling, and it'll be the most important design skill, I think, that anyone can learn.
Are there certain takeaways from that conversation that stood out, or maybe even just specific things that you notice in the best storytelling designers that you've worked alongside?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, he put a really great emphasis on storytelling not having to be theater. You know, some of the negative stereotypes that people have, the reason why there's an aversion to the concept of storytelling in design practice is, you know, the examples that he brought up were things like Don Draper and everyone thinking that it has to be theatrical and performative and even to the point of just dressing something up as opposed to being truthful. And he showed many counterexamples of what it means to apply great narrative structure to find a compelling ability to capture your audience's attention and really zero them in on the essential and to have them brought along towards a productive outcome of a conversation. And, you know, he had various methods that were specific to his approach, but they were still just fundamentally his take on some of the best practices around storytelling in any context. He used examples from movies. You know, here's a great example of Back to the Future and like how does narrative structure inform your engagement with that story, but then translating it to very real practical applied examples of like digital design practitioners and agencies and product teams. So I thought it was amazing. And we do that with like a range of other people. Like it changes every year as we do learning and development with our teams. And there are a lot of internal advocates for it who have their own, you know, oh, this was a great one that we did last week and it was so successful. But it's the most in demand topic still. Like whenever we ask people what they want to learn about, like all the hands go there. It's not the only one, but it definitely is the most consistently asked for.
I mean, that's been my experience even with this podcast is people keep messaging me and be like, I want to learn more about storytelling, or like, I really like that part where you talked about storytelling. So I'm going to double click on the movie part, because in preparing for this call, I messaged a past colleague, Julie Steffen, and she said that you are really good at applying movie frameworks for storytelling. What does that look like?
I'm first going to give like due credit to Ian Wharton, because his workshop is so fresh in my mind that I'm greatly at risk of like plagiarizing what he told us. But his examples were around inciting incidents and the escalation of action in a film, and how that is done to really effectively land at the end of the day a resolution that is satisfying. And I think, you know, that same thing happens in a product conversation, but sometimes like people aren't aware of it. And, you know, to a certain point, you mimic the vibe of describing a movie in the same way that you describe a certain, let's say, piece of context, like the reason we're here. In the case of Upwork, it's like the pandemic has just suddenly changed everything almost overnight. And so many people are now working from home and learning that in a way that they wouldn't have been doing before. And to be able to use that and to intersperse, whether it's visually on slides like animated GIFs from movies that reinforce the emotion of the moment you're trying to describe, or whether it's just like mimicking not the tone of a movie trailer, but just some of the familiar paces. It's, you know, humans consume storytelling all the time, and it's just a way to make it interesting. Like, I think a boring conversation about product or a boring presentation is probably the death of good ideas. And like, you know, even world-changing stuff, if you just crawl through it in a linear, methodical way, will just, you know, you'll lose your collaborators and your audience.
I like the Upwork example a lot, because you're right. It's almost like reimagining the starting point of where the story begins, because a lot of times you ask for a storytelling tactic and it's like, well, use the voice of the person that's actually like, you know, using the software. I am a founder and I am looking for so-and-so, and I'm trying to fill this need in my company. And like, yes, that's totally true. That isn't something that you can and probably should be doing, but setting that more emotional stage about, you know, it's COVID and I can't work with the people down the street anymore, so I'm trying to figure out what's next. That's a really unique angle that I think often does get forgotten.
Yeah. And it's, the thing is, it's not fiction or entertainment. Like, these are the real drivers that create billion-dollar industries, or, you know, make people move from one thing to the next. Like, you know, Zoom as a product, you know, COVID had a meaningful impact on Zoom becoming like a household name in, you know, in the world. And all of these things evolve based on what's happening in the world. And I think the biggest danger is for designers in our industry to be myopic and to only be thinking of like, oh, we have a job to be done from a user and let's design a feature. And then fast forward 10 years later and things like the sharing economy are created with all the good and bad things that come from that. I think taking into account real world communities, culture, the impacts of what we do, and intentionally building that into our product choices is not only like a useful thing, it to my mind should be a mandatory thing. That's how we do not only great design, but responsible, ethical, beneficial to the world and to the businesses that we're serving. You know, all of those things, like, you have to actually say the thing, talk about what is going to be meaningfully impacting your work. And it often gets skipped. You just start it like, hey, we're not converting as much on this onboarding flow. What are we going to do about it? If you don't take a step back, you may miss the entire reason.
Can I get super in the weeds for a second? Because we're talking about a lot of interesting things. And you also mentioned how, you know, for some of these client touch points, you're getting into pitch and creating presentations. What are some of the pieces of advice that you would offer to designers who want to improve the way that they're creating and structuring these presentations? Like, what makes for a good deck that's really going to communicate effectively, but also get a client excited when you're right in the middle of this design process?
Some of those things are easiest to describe by the opposite of successful, but I think like what I try to...
I think that's a great way to do it, actually. If you want to go with that route, I think that actually is very helpful.
Yeah, like a bad presentation, especially one supported by a deck, has got a lot of things. So like one of them is too much information that the audience can't parse, as in there's like a million things on the slide, there's a million things being said, there's not a clear relationship between all of them, and you're just being fed more and more and more and more information without any of a narrative structure that allows you to actually think and engage in the story. So overload is a big one. I think, you know, not making a presentation that's actually a support to a presentation. A lot of people create decks as if it's a leave behind, like a book that's meant to be read, as opposed to the visual support to a verbally presented presentation. And that means that, like, you don't have to write on the slide all the things you're going to say. You can actually have a visual that supports the thing you're going to say, or the opposite. Sometimes you put a big statement on a slide and don't say it. And there's so many ways that you can play between the presenter and the presentation. If you ever watch like a TED Talk or, you know, a Design Thinkers conference, like the ones that do it well really are playing with the material that they have, the visual and what they're saying, and even their own body language. And people who create those decks often are just like, well, we're going to do a demo. I'm going to put all the stuff on the deck, and then I'm going to crawl through the deck to show you what's in there. But they're not thinking of it as a communication to the person who's listening. So I usually try to recommend that, and then to dramatically simplify it so that it's clear what you're saying. I think that, like, a lot of times when a team collects a deck together, there's a risk that someone took one section and someone else took another section, and then they got four people to help on that slide, and you don't really get a story that flows through it. I've shared often with the team that when I'm going to write a presentation, I sometimes just walk my dog and talk into the recorder, Google recorder on the phone, and just try to like rip it out that way, and then use the transcribed notes to break it out into like a narrative arc. And your brain more naturally thinks in storytelling format that way because we've just experienced it since we were babies. From like the very first time we got like a kid's book read to us, like we've internalized how to tell a compelling story to another person. But for some reason, we forget all of it when we have to do it formally in the work context with the tools. So simple slides with one major point and very impactful presentation of those points, whether it's a visual, an animation, a word. I think the last one is just don't insult the intelligence of your audience. Like, really assume that they're the smartest, best people, and you're probably going to make a presentation that is worthy of that attention.
I want to ask one more question in this storytelling bucket. And really, actually, it's just a quote that I read of yours that stood out to me that I'm hoping you can unpack a little bit. You said, "A designer's job is to help great work make it out into the world with its intention intact." Can you talk a little bit about what you meant by that?
I think every designer has felt the pain of having, you know, the enthusiasm and the passion of like thinking and imagining something that they're like, I think this is great. I love it. And then, you know, people will call it either design by committee or death by a thousand cuts or compromises or even just like losing track of what you're doing over the long course of getting something from original idea out into the world. Like if you have a concept and then go through high level design, production design, engineering, testing, you know, that arc of things can be quite a bit. And there's a million people involved and stakeholders. And like, even if the thing changes, it doesn't matter as long as the intention remains the same. Like, what made something special in the first place, and what was it trying to achieve for the users, people in the world, the business, that kind of thing. If those things are maintained, then the thing that comes out in the world may not be that original Figma design that you have, but it'll have all the important things that were in there. But if those things don't carry through, it can be just a completely different beast and become something that, like, maybe it did do the job, but it's not that wonderful thing that you were first inspired by. And I think, you know, we always aim to do work that's not simply getting the job done, but that has pushed the thinking forward for digital product. And that's hopefully the bigger ambition in everything that you do, is to, like, you know, we're all participants in an industry that we want to advance it in some way. You know, the first time someone made a big full screen mega menu on desktop, as opposed to like a little fly out of a drawer, that, you know, that caught on and that changed things, you know, and that made a meaningful introduction of something new. That's, you want that intention to carry through. And I think storytelling relates to that, especially if it can be done like the elevator pitch is something that business people understand the value of. And I described a little bit why naming things, we do that with features and concepts too. So if you name something and give it like, I don't know, your workiversary. That's usually when like you've been at work for like a year and Slack gives you like, I don't know, some kind of like a message. Giving it a name is the easiest way for an intention to be bundled into a good name. And then even if the way it's executed changes, the intention stays the same. You want to celebrate someone and recognize they're seen as a user and a customer.
It's really cool. I love the idea of bundling intention? Because I've heard people recommend giving concepts names almost just as a way to make them stick and help like get your ideas bought into. But preserving intention through a name is a really interesting angle that I haven't heard before.
Yeah, it's like the intention DNA of the organism that is an idea, and like it can evolve and change as long as that one thing stays the same.
Let's zoom out for a little bit, because you know my background is predominantly in-house, so I'm kind of curious about some of the differences between agency work and in-house work, and maybe just some of the things that I wouldn't even know existed. So maybe my question is, let's say that somebody joins MetaLab for the first time and they're coming from an in-house role. What are some of the skills that you think they would have to ramp up on in order to succeed in that new role?
So, I mean, historically, there was much more of a difference between design practices from like established in-house teams to agencies. They were very different. And I think over time, they've started to inform each other so much, just with people moving around, with so much being shared on Medium and articles or just out in the world and talks about, you know, how things work and just the maturation of our practice. But there still are some really real differences. And I think we always ask ourselves, like, why do people come to us in the first place? Like, every single client we work with, you know, whether they're a large enterprise or a startup, already is amazing at something they do. It's not like they're trying to buy a base ability that they don't have. So in a lot of cases, like there is a really essential complementary ingredient that is important to come from a third party. And I think that that's like almost the definition of agency, is like a couple of things. Like an outside perspective is a really important one. So an agency will work across a ton of different industries and fields and yet see a lot of the commonalities as to like the approaches, the perspectives that make different companies successful in their respective domains, even though technically one of them is going to be in healthcare, one will be in finance, one will be in education, and one will be in social media. Yet there are tons of commonalities that can inform each other. And I think a lot of people, whether they be founders or, you know, business leaders inside of large companies, value that transference of perspective, because the biggest challenge anyone has is not knowing what they don't know. So I think that's always been a really good reason why agencies, not only in digital design, but in brand or in even forms of like consulting or like hardware, like exists, is because they get exposure to like a wide range of problems. And we, you know, even when we do a market scan to be like, hey, what's going to inform the state of the art for your product? Well, we always look like not just adjacent, but really broadly. And I think that that's something that you see less of in the conversations that happen day to day in house. We work very often as upstream as we possibly can, and not all in-house teams are given that opportunity dependent on their business structure. So, you know, the ability to be able to foundationally question some of the things that we discussed in the early hypothesis is not necessarily afforded to business units within a larger company. Or conversely, like founders sometimes came from a very specific point of view and haven't had the ability or the time to really have that challenge. Maybe sometimes they do it again intentionally when they come to a funding round where they really realize that they're going to be, you know, hit with a lot of considerations that were not meaningful in their previous one, because times change, you know, from 2022 to 2024, the conversation around AI has. And then the specialization, as in like agencies, like sometimes are able to develop specialized skill sets in certain areas that aren't necessarily permanently available to clients, and they really want to inject that into their process in a way that just unblocks or accelerates a moment in time. And that could be, you know, something very technical, like the ability to work really with like data and quant from like a research perspective, or it could be someone who's really versed in, you know, in AI or an emerging technology like spatial computing, or it could be simply like having people from a brand strategy perspective, which they don't have in their, you know, in their team skill set. That's a more complementary kind of thing, but I like to think of it just from an experience perspective. I think we work really fast across a lot of stuff, and we try to create these moments of really almost pressure cooker that are really productive. And it does attract people who seek that out, like a higher refresh rate, working on something wildly different every couple of months, a little bit of the excitement of high stakes. On the downside, we're not always there at the finish line. Like, we don't always get to like see a product ship or be around for all of its iterations. We do a lot of 0-to-1 where we launch and build the very first instance of a product, but we don't necessarily get to take it to version 2 or 3 or 4 and get that satisfaction of like learning from the behaviors of real users using it at scale and moving it to the next place. So, you know, there's a lot of trade-offs and differences, but I think like those two circles are overlapping more and more, I think.
So I'm just going to repeat some of the trends that I was hearing. One is like this ability to kind of see the forest above the trees and identify some of these commonalities across industries. You also talked about the ability to work upstream and even feeling comfortable, not only contributing to strategy, but maybe even pushing back on top level strategy. And then this high refresh rate, like just being able to ramp up quickly within a problem space. My question then is, how does this impact what you are looking for in candidates? Like, are there things that designers can do, maybe in their portfolio, maybe in the hiring process, that would make you say, wow, like I gotta have this person on the team?
Everyone has a different perspective, but the ones that I really value when, you know, I sit in a lot of interviews, do a lot of the hiring, and I think one of them is a sense of constantly looking for the art of the possible. So when challenged with a very difficult task, not trying to block it in to say like, what is it that we can do given these constraints, but really to ask the question, like, I wonder, like, what if we could do this? Is that possible? Like, let's try it. And I think that that's a really intangible thing, but it is born of a place that you really are aiming for the highest possible end outcome and are willing to fight tooth and nail for that, rather than looking for the most pragmatic solution. Even though MetaLab is very grounded, especially compared to many agencies I've been in, and never shaking the fact that we want this thing to go into the world and to launch, nothing we do is an intellectual exercise in and of itself, but still like people who are like willing to be like, you know what, give me a couple hours, let me go try something. Like, I just want to go see if that could work out, rather than people that would like to debate endlessly to disregard an idea because it presents, you know, a non-obvious solution. I think the other one is like the POV part. So I think that like it is very difficult when you see descriptions of process. I'm sure if you've seen like a double diamond diagram or like, you know, agile process for software or any description of like process, it becomes a little bit like Fordism, like an assembly line. And if you just collect all the information and do synthesis, it'll eventually lead to the one only possible outcome that it ever could have been, as if there were like a scientific outcome to it. But I think that point of view and the human background that informs doing something different and crazy and unexpected that people will fall in love with, or that does a thing that businesses didn't naturally prioritize, that comes from people who are willing, even if it scares the shit out of them, to have that conversation with a CEO. Like, we worked directly for months and months with Nick Thompson, the CEO of The Atlantic, and his partner at Emerson Collective, Rafi Krikorian, works deeply on AI, and we're working on a project with them in the work like every other day. And you know, you need team members who are going to be like, you know what, like, despite the amazing intelligences and personalities of these people, like, I have an opinion too. And like, I'd like to challenge that. And I'd like to show you what this could be. And we routinely work directly with CEOs and founders. And even our most junior team members are in that room going, wait a minute, let's consider this. And I think that that's really important to have people who want that, you know, that they see the value in that. It's not just like a thing that you can learn or develop or train, that you can do too. But people who feel like, you know, like, we're all intelligent people, let's try to do something crazy and let's disregard hierarchy for a moment in service of something bigger.
I like how it connects back to something you said earlier, like the designing to find the answer instead of finding the answer to design. Like, it's just like this proactiveness where it's like constantly just asking yourself, what if, and running with it, rather than, like you said, like synthesizing based off of some kind of a repeatable process. That's a really, really interesting way of putting it.
Yeah, like it puts the human designer back in the driver's seat, as in we are not just the facilitator of a machine that spits out great design. We are, it's our intentions, our hopes and dreams. And that's, you know, that resonates with founders and CEOs. There's a reason those people are successful, because they had an intention that was different than what the market was doing, than different than what most people thought made sense. You know, when Airbnb came out, like, that bucked the convention of what people would want to take a nice vacation in France by, you know, staying in someone's, you know, bedroom. That was counterintuitive, I think is the term I'd use.
Okay, so let's continue this example and say that someone has effectively sold you on this idea that they are someone that can conceive like the art of the possible. You've brought them onto the team. It's been 2, maybe 3 years. And now I'd like to juxtapose like the before and after versions of that designer since they joined you. What is a way that you would expect them to have grown while working at MetaLab?
Oh, yeah. There's one fundamental way. It's experience gives you a muscle memory of the arc of a project. And every project has, you know, the enthusiasm of week one and then the just utter valley of despair when you're in like week four and you're not at all sure if this thing is the right thing to do or there's so many different conflicting points of views and inputs. And the truth is that like you have to have faith that a small group of intelligent people working hard together, pushing through it, yes, working extremely hard in some situations, do get to a productive outcome. And I think that, you know, the thing that you hear so often for people who first start is like, wow, there's so much ahead of me. You know, like I'm so daunted by, we're going to change the face of this industry or this app, or we're going to make this whole thing that much better. And they really struggle with seeing the whole future laid out ahead. But once you've done it once, twice, three times, four times, a dozen times, you start to recognize that this is where we should be in that story. This is the second act where, you know, Han Solo gets frozen in carbonite and it sucks. You know, like that's
movie frameworks.
Yeah, there it is. Like, you know, it just, that's where you are and you know where you are on that journey and you're able to give confidence to the clients who may be freaking out too. You give confidence to your team members. You give confidence to yourself to be able to try something and to, like the hardest part is when something's not good and you're very far in the process to recognize that you do need to take a step back and tear it all down and build it back up. And it's the last thing you want to do when you're like, oh, we have a deadline and a deliverable, but someone who's been through it once, twice, three times will recognize that moment and take that action. And I think that that's just, it's the hard won lessons of doing rather than simply relying on, you know, theoretical descriptions of process or the managing of just stuff to do.
Well, Mike, we've covered a lot of ground. This has been a very high juice per minute, which is my new favorite metric to measure things by.
It's a good one.
Is there anything else that I should be asking or anything else that you want to share before I let you go?
I think it's just good for everyone to recognize that like this used to be like a weird space that only specific people worked on. And the things that we made were only for a small group of people who liked to be on the cutting edge of like, you know, digital products and tools. It now touches everything. So why not bring everything into the work, whether it be like old forms of graphic design and art direction or the book that you read or where you grew up or, you know, what your grandparents said. Like every single possible input into our design process will make digital product design better than what it has been in some instances where it's like sealed off from the world and doing things that are a bit tone deaf to like what the world needs from the tools that we use every day. So my hope is that like if you come to MetaLab, you get to make something that's going to be in just about everybody's phone. Odds are if you pull out your phone, you'll be using a product that we made. And then that's going to do something that's going to be cool or fun or helpful or even life-changing for someone. So why not bring everything into that? Don't only read, you know, Medium articles or things about product design. Bring every ingredient to the table that you possibly can. I think that's what I would love for people to remember out of the work that we do and what went into it.
It's a beautiful way to wrap up. Thank you, Mike. This has been really, really enjoyable. I appreciate you taking the time to share with us today.
No, thank you so much. Best conversation I had all week.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, each week I send an email to over 10,000 designers with featured resources and key insights that you can use to take a leap forward in your career. Head to dive.club/email if you want to sign up. I'll see you next week.